This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, January 15th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas speaks with blogger Michael Cook about Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar's resignation. Plus, award-winning documentarian Perry Miller-Adato discusses her work and gives tips to aspiring filmmakers.
Also, solar energy in Arkansas, three things we should know about towing, and more. But first, Department of Finance and Administration officials outlined specific state budget priorities in a legislative hearing yesterday. Governor Mike Beebe is proposing a $5 billion budget for the coming year. It boosts funding for education, human services, and the state's prison system. Brandon Sharp is the administrator of the Office of Budget. He fielded lawmakers' questions yesterday and said the Medicaid private option was the major topic of discussion.
About $85 million in tax cuts were passed during the regular session, will hit in fiscal year 2015. Those were offset through some savings that we were going to get through uncompensated care or state agencies like UAMS who have been providing services to the public for people that didn't have insurance. Well, under the private option, a lot of those people have insurance, which has allowed us to kind of reduce their budgets.
Sharp said he is hopeful the budget process will go smoothly.
It addresses a lot of the pressing needs that we have, but it is predicated upon continuation of the private option. And so if that doesn't pass, then there will be a need to go back and revisit a lot of these budget numbers.
Sharp said Governor Beebe's budget proposal calls for a $105.8 million increase in state funding, with the largest increase going toward the state's public schools.
The state's private option may be in danger after a special state Senate election held yesterday in northeast Arkansas. Republican John Cooper won the special election for the District 21 Senate seat. According to unofficial numbers from the Craighead County Clerk's Office, Cooper defeated Democrat Steve Rockwell with 57% of the vote. Here's his reaction after winning.
Most of our campaign is door-to-door, and we connect with the voters one-on-one at their door. We answer their questions, and voters like to see their representative is working, and they like to see that he's interested in them.
Thank you.
And we're so grateful that our message connected with the voters of this region.
The race had focused primarily on the compromise plan to expand Medicaid approved by the legislature this year. Cooper says he will elect to defund the private option plan when the legislature meets next month.
We've had it figured out for a while. I think the A lot of this election was about the private option, and I think a statement's been made about the way the community feels about that, and we will be voting against the private option.
No matter what?
Well, yeah, I think we could say that. I don't see anything coming on the scene that would impact that to a degree that would change that.
According to complete but unofficial numbers, Cooper received 4,341 votes, while Rockwell picked up 3,227 votes. Cooper replaces former Democratic State Senator Paul Bookout, who resigned last year after being fired by the Arkansas Ethics Commission for spending thousands of dollars in campaign funds on personal items such as clothing and theater equipment. The 21st District covers all of Jonesboro and most of Craighead County.
Arkansas doctors who opted for care coordination payments will start receiving supplemental payments this month. More than 600 primary care physicians enrolled to be patient-centered medical homes, a concept encouraging management of chronic conditions and preventative care using financial incentives. William Golden, medical director for Arkansas Medicaid, says the goal is to have primary physicians handle the majority of care.
Doctors would be available, or someone from the office would be available 24/7 by voice, that there would be better availability of same-day appointments so that the need to go to the emergency room would be reduced, that patients would understand their chronic disease care so that there'd be less confusion.
Golden adds that this concept is being used throughout the country, but Arkansas is considering allowing physicians to share in the savings generated by the program.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith is in the process of developing its first master's degree program. Dr. Ray Wallace, Provost and Senior Vice Chancellor of UAFS, says the online Master's of Science in Healthcare Administration is a logical development for the university and states a need for more highly trained healthcare professionals in the local and state community.
We've grown quite dramatically in terms of our offerings at the four-year level. And so this is a natural progression. Hospitals, healthcare administrators, some of our graduates in nursing, some of our business graduates and their employers started to call us and say, hey, what are our opportunities here? And so we looked at our strengths, our bench strength in particular areas in the health sciences. And healthcare administration was certainly our strongest area.
But to offer a master's degree, Wallace says the role and scope of the university must be changed at the same time the degree program is proposed.
And it goes all the way from the University of Arkansas System Board to the Arkansas Department of Higher Education Board and then to the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association. And so that's three major steps. We're fortunate that the first step went well. The University of Arkansas system unanimously voted for us to begin that process. So that was great. They recognized that we had the potential for this.
This isn't the first time the role and scope of UAFS has changed. Since joining the University of Arkansas system in 2002, the university has shifted from primarily offering two-year degrees to offering several four-year bachelor's degree programs. We'll have more on the development of the UAFS master's degree program later this week on Ozarks.
Forecast this evening calls for partly cloudy skies with overnight lows around 26 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, mostly sunny with highs from 52 in northwest Arkansas to 58 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with overnight lows from 23 in northwest Arkansas to 28 in the River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. There have been plenty of developments in the Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar saga, calls for his impeachment and calls for his resignation. He did actually resign late Friday night. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas sat down with former Lieutenant Governor Chief of Staff Michael Cook, who once worked for Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter and now blogs for TalkBusiness.net to learn more.
First of all, let's talk about what he said in his resignation letter. Took a shot at the governor, a veiled shot at the governor.
Yeah, took a shot at the governor. Basically, he stumbled off the stage without much graciousness. He took a shot at the governor and some other folks, didn't really accept too much responsibility to say he made mistakes and didn't have malicious intent. This whole affair has been just one big mess in terms of, he started off the week saying, I'm putting a stake in the ground, I'm not leaving. In the end, Friday night at 5-6 o'clock, he says, oh yeah, by the way, I'm resigning.
Yeah.
So it just sort of stumbled and bumbled, just sort of like how he has through this whole affair.
What do you think, that he just finally accepted and acknowledged the political pressure from all of the Republicans calling for his resignation, much less the Democrats that have been calling for his resignation?
I think it was two things. One was good old-fashioned money. One thing I wasn't even aware of until this whole thing came about, if he was convicted by the state Senate, he was
in an impeachment trial,
mm-hmm. he would have to probably pay about $50,000 for the cost. So that in and of itself was number one. But then number two, he really had no allies. I mean, the entire federal Republican delegation said, please resign. A lot of other state legislatures said, it's time to go. He really had no real significant base of support. And I think by the end of the week, he saw, he knew he was going to get impeached. So it just might as well leave because it's coming down.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the timetable now and just a little bit of context. I'm going to go deep in the weeds on a few things here. He says he's going to resign on February 1st.
Right.
That's a Saturday. Mm-hmm. Conceivably, the governor doesn't get that letter until Monday morning, February 3rd. The governor is required by law to, within 10 days, set the dates for a special election. So there is time with the legislature convening on February 10th, 7 days into that 10-day period, for them to actually change the law if they want to not require a special election?
Yeah, it could be a big mess. I mean, first of all, I personally don't think there should be a special election. Mm-hmm. I mean, I support John Burkhalter for lieutenant governor. I make no bones about it. But the bottom line is, I don't think it's worth the expense of having a special election for an office. The term was going to end anyway in January. Yeah. Lieutenant governor office has no real authority. And then third, Michael Lamoureux, the president pro tem, he would next in line in succession. Mm-hmm. Heaven forbid something happens to Governor Beebe. He'd be fine for the next, you know, remainder of the term. He's a competent, well-regarded, well-respected legislator. So I don't think we need to spend the money.
Yeah. So, and if that is truly what the legislative intent may be in terms of walking through that scenario that mm-hmm. I outlined there, then they do escape having to have that special election. Right. Do you think there's any potential political fallout for that? Do you think the people across the state of Arkansas say, no, we should have a lieutenant governor, somebody that should be governor by election if something should happen?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, we had the sad tragedy in 2006 when then Lieutenant Governor Win Rockefeller passed mm-hmm. away in July. You know, this, everybody decided let's just leave it open for 6 months. Nobody in the state decried we must have an election. I think the people are fine, especially when you tell them we can save $1 million or we can spend the money for this office that really has no power unless the governor vacates the office.
It's the second reference you've made to this office has no power. You served as the chief of staff of this office.
You know, it's an office of what you make. I mean, mm-hmm. when Bill Halter was lieutenant governor, his big goal, and he got it accomplished, was the Arkansas lottery. That was a monumental, almost a sea change to, you know, the higher education. But beyond that, you know, your job is to, if the governor vacates the office through mm-hmm. death or resignation or what have you, you become governor. Whenever he's out of state, you're the governor, and you preside over the state senate. So the actual formal duties are small, but you can make a lot out of it.
Well, should we have a lieutenant governor? Then there's been arguments that have been made that we shouldn't have a lieutenant governor, that the senate president could serve in that capacity, or governors could run on a ticket with a lieutenant governor of some sort, which we're seeing Mike Ross and John Burkhalter at least try to pair.
For me, I think the bottom line is you have to have a lieutenant governor who is elected by the people. You know, in some states, they run as a ticket where the gubernatorial nominee picks his own lieutenant governor, his or her own nominee for lieutenant governor. And we have places like Arkansas where they run separate. I don't like the idea of a president pro tem automatically becoming governor for a full term, because mm-hmm. that person is only elected by
75,000 people or something like that. What's the?
Well, no, not even that. I mean, you know, as a president pro term, you're elected by your colleagues
in the
Senate. So basically, 17, 16 people can determine who the next governor is. I don't think that's very democratic. So I still like the idea of having a lieutenant governor elected by the people.
So does Mark Dar, with this resignation and leaving office, does he still become a weapon that Democrats can use against Republicans?
Oh,
or how does it play out now in terms of the political ramifications
of
this?
Well, I think number one, this whole affair pretty much guarantees John Burkhalter as our next lieutenant governor.
Now, how's that?
For two reasons. First of all, Burkhalter has never been elected to office. He's a businessman. Mm-hmm. Whoever his opponent is, whether it's Charlie Collins or Andy Mayberry, both are elected officials. So Burkhalter gets to paint these guys, you know, we need to elect a businessman to this office. We need to get rid of these politicians and bring integrity back to the office. So he's got that mantle that he can wear, and the other two guys are, well, I worked in the state legislature, I'm part of the political process, number one. Number two, it's kind of like the same problem that Democrats are having in the treasurer's race, in that maybe voters says, well, we had a Democrat this time, maybe we give it to a Republican next time. Could be the same thing with lieutenant governor. Well, we gave it to a Republican, he mucked it all up, so let's give the Democrat a try.
Do you think it might not be, though, that you've got the voting electorate who thinks to themselves, they don't really distinguish between the Democrat and the Republican. Mm-hmm. They're just, if they're elected, they're bad, or we have a bad feeling about them, and maybe just a whole throw the bums out mentality, or I mean, could that be at work or at play too?
It could be, but you know, Democrats will be, you know, in terms of the lieutenant governor's race, will be making a point of let's restore integrity and honor to the race for lieutenant governor. And there's also potential, and I say potential, that it could wash over slightly, at least into the governor's race, in that, well, if I'm going to vote for the Democrat for lieutenant governor, I might as well vote for the same as governor. I do think the biggest impact will be in the lieutenant governor's race, maybe a slight potential for governor.
Yeah, well, that kind of bucks your previous philosophical position on the fact that Arkansas voters are very independent.
We're independent, but, you know, you never know. In terms of, you know, what we want to do, we are a quirky electorate. in terms of what we do all from one election, even sometimes in the same election. I mean, this is the state in 2012, we voted heavily against Barack Obama, but then came within a few thousand votes of legalizing medical marijuana. So, I mean, that's a classic example of two completely different positions, seemingly.
That was Michael Cook, former Lieutenant Governor Chief of Staff and TalkBusiness.net blogger, speaking with Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at mitchellwilliamslaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com.
Coming up on Ozarks at Large, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith is organizing a two-day symposium that will offer a how-to guide for potential candidates in upcoming elections.
The main reasons why we're doing this is that, we operate under a political system that depends on citizen participation. And so this workshop was designed in order to give people insight and knowledge, background, into how to run for office.
That's coming up in about 12 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Residential and commercial solar energy system installation is on the rise in Arkansas. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, compared to other solar-rich states, Arkansas lacks incentives for solar deployment and utility standards. And this year, renewable energy advocates are facing organized opposition from carbon producers who don't want them on their grid.
Bill Morgan and his spouse, Michelle Austin, live on 40 acres in Hazel Valley, 20 miles southeast of Fayetteville. They operate several greenhouses, growing much of their food year-round, and live in an energy-efficient home, tapping electricity produced by a large pole-mounted solar array erected in a pasture this morning facing the low winter sun.
This 3,000-watt array here has been online for a little over a year. You know, and all the mathematics we did on it all panned out. So that's a third of it. We're putting in another 6,000 watts over the next couple of days.
Are you off grid or on grid?
We're on. We're putting it back into the grid and letting them hold on to the electricity for us.
Meaning Morgan doesn't house a bank of batteries to store produced energy. The direct current is piped to an inverter box fixed on a nearby Ozarks electric-owned utility pole, transformed into alternating current, which supplies a house. Excess current is diverted into the power supply grid at large. Morgan is being compensated by the utility for the produced solar power through net metering.
Well, we're seeing a third credit on our bill every month from what we're generating, and that was exactly the way it was supposed to be.
The initial investment for the current solar setup was $13,000. The two new arrays will cost $22,000. A third of the cost is being paid for by the Fed through the Residential Renewable Energy Tax Credit Program, enacted in 2006.
It's real rewarding, you know, any sunny day like right now, and watch the meter of what I'm using spinning rather slowly and watch the one of what I'm generating really moving.
A four-man crew with Rocky Grove Sun Company based in Kingston is here today trenching and laying conduit pipe in preparation for the two new grid-tied arrays. Company founder Jim Dement.
So it's a win-win situation because it's not wasted in any way.
Rocky Grove Sun Company started up in 1986, serving mostly homesteaders and owners looking to source renewable power self-sufficiently off the grid, storing produced power on site. But grid-tied systems like this one are trending, and business for Rocky Grove is up 25% over the preceding year. Dement's partner is Flint Richter.
You know, grid-tied systems are the most efficient and easiest to install and design, so they should be the nation's most popular system because they're what we really need. The battery-based systems they include a lot of lead and natural resources that we really don't need to include in lots of solar arrays.
Rocky Grove Sun Company negotiates with 6 different utilities across the 3-state regions. The excess electricity is strictly regulated, says Jim Dement.
That excess power rolls over to the next month. If you need that, it'll keep rolling over until 4 months into the next year. So in most cases, that would use up any excess because, you know, our worst solar years or solar months are November, December, and then it gets increasingly better January through February. But the probability is that you would use up any surplus that you might carry over.
The latest evolution in the state's net metering law, which are set by the state legislature in concert with the Arkansas Public Service Commission, a sustainable energy feed-in tariff bill has been proposed 3 times in Arkansas, says Flint Richter, but has been soundly defeated by utilities' pushback.
A feed-in tariff would actually pay people to produce energy. So where you buy it for 10 cents, a feed-in tariff might pay you 20 cents to produce it, so you could actually make money from producing solar. And utilities would be forced to buy a certain amount of what you produce at a certain rate.
Feed-in tariffs, or FITs, was promulgated under the Carter administration's National Energy Act in the late 1970s to encourage renewable energy conservation and development. Popular in the European Union, FITs are perceived in the United States by utilities as a burden upon ratepayers. But advocates say those utilities simply want to maintain production monopolies. Again, Flint Richter.
Germany has, you know, their whole solar installation nationwide is fed by the feed-in tariff. That's why they have the largest amount of solar in the world, and they have half the solar resource we do.
Arkansas, Richter says, is ranked 16th in the nation for solar resources, the amount of sun that falls on our state, receiving on average more than 5,000 watts per square meter. Steve Patterson is executive director of the Arkansas Advanced Energy Association, which counts 100 members and businesses involved in energy efficiency, green energy product manufacturing, renewable energy production, as well as compressed natural gas production. AAEA also engages in policy advocacy at the federal, state, and regulatory level. Steve Patterson says while Arkansas counts 240 renewable energy facilities, we rank low in solar, but that's changing.
The solar industry is primed to take off here. It is already doing quite well as the price for solar has come down considerably in the last 2 years and is much more marketable and affordable to mainstream consumers.
Experts say carbon inputs in the United States are declining due to the shuttering of dirty coal plants and increased wind and solar energy facilities, which saw the largest growth in 2013. And one thing that's helping is a recent tweak in the state's net metering law.
Energy consumption at more than 1 meter against the energy generated by a renewable energy facility, such as a geothermal installation or a windmill or a solar array.
So college and corporate campuses, farms, and rural water districts with multiple meters can see a capital offset on installation costs. But Arkansas lacks a renewable portfolio standard, a state regulation that would mandate that a certain percentage of the state's energy production come from renewable resources by specified target dates. For now, Patterson says, 10% of the state's energy comes from renewable sources, pointing to hydro and paper mill biomass in South Arkansas, as well as wind production in Texas and Oklahoma. Steve Patterson says we also lack any state incentives for solar.
As you know, the state doesn't have any tax credits or other incentives in place. So the only thing we are that is encouraging solar deployment in Arkansas is a federal tax credit.
And for a time, rebates from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, remember that? According to the Arkansas Energy Office based in Little Rock, it delivered $1.8 million in rebates, generating, Patterson says, $5.3 million in private investment. But clouds are gathering to block America's solar gain. This year, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC for short, backed by carbon industry interests, members, and politicians, plan to disrupt expansion of renewable energy development. ALEC has generated model bills, which it reportedly plans to distribute to state legislatures to spur laws to charge residential and commercial renewable energy producers fees for the privilege of tapping onto the electrical grid. Again, Steve Patterson.
The renewable energy customer is, in fact, utilizing the transmission lines that are being supplied by other customers. But we'll also argue that that customer's personal investment in a renewable energy facility must be taken into account.
Back in sunny Hazel Valley in Washington County, the Rocky Grove Sun Company crew are acutely aware of pending ALEC bills that frame independent solar producers as freeloaders on the electrical grid. This is Flint Richter.
So it's not like these customers are paying zero, you know, with their solar or electric. They are already paying a monthly fee for the privilege of having a meter. And I think it's unfair to penalize, you know, solar customers who are actually making the grid more stable.
Owner Jimis Demet worries levying additional surcharges will discourage residential solar adoption.
Instead of being so concentrated on producing power, they should be more of a power broker.
And to make a point, Dement describes what will happen once they finish installing the two additional solar arrays on the Morgan Austin property.
So it'll be about, what, nine kilowatts of power. So if we have, say, five peak sun hours of getting 9 kilowatts, let's say, then that's 45 kilowatts a day. So, and then that times 30 keeps mounting up, and you're obviously producing a significant amount of your own power, if not all of it, and then some.
The average Arkansas home uses 900 kilowatt hours per month, more or less, or 30 per day. So the Morgan Austin home will soon be a major net producer of electricity. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Arkansas Energy Office in Little Rock lists local solar power contractors as well as federal and state incentives for solar power. You can visit the office's website at arkansasenergy.org. It is Wednesday, January 15th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I still feel a little like we're doing this behind Dad's back.
I mean, a little.
It's fun this way.
Girls only.
How much trouble can we get into?
Oh,
see, there you go. All right, let's talk about music if we're going to get in trouble anyway.
Okay.
Let's talk about country music songwriter and vocalist Tom Brash, who is going to be on stage at 8 o'clock Thursday at Second Street Live in Fort Smith. He is the son of Merle Travis.
Oh.
Who knew? Kevin Kinder, who does our music writing.
Of course he did.
I didn't know. And apparently he's important because tickets are $40 at secondstreetlive.com. Or there's the Waka Winter Classic.
There is that. I know what that is.
When people get very excited, not all of the Waka lineup is set, although Kevin is introducing it on his music blog at nwatunedin.com as soon as they release it. But they're always seeking new talent, and several bands are coming to Georgia's to try out. This happens starting at 9 o'clock Thursday. Starting at 9 o'clock, and there's how many bands?
There's quite a few.
Golly, I'm old. Revolution Butterfly, Randall Shreve and the Sideshow, Cadillac Jackson, Foley's Van, Space Camp, and Don't Stop Please. We'll be auditioning for Waka, and you can find out more on the Georgia's Majestic Lounge website.
Yes, the winner will actually get to play at Waka Russa.
Exactly.
And the last round of announcements for the bands that are playing will be out tomorrow.
Cool.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Just in case you weren't counting, there are 291 days until the general election in November and just 124 days before the party primaries in Arkansas this spring. But another important election-related deadline is approaching. Candidates for office can begin formally filing their intentions to run February 24th. The filing period will last until March 3rd. Later this month, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith is offering a how-to guide for potential candidates. Topics covered in the two-day symposium include rules about filing, fundraising, and more. Ozarks at-large's Kyle Kellums recently talked to UAFS officials about the workshop.
For years, reporters seeking opinions from voters have sought out coffee shops or diners to ask the cliched average citizen what she or he thinks about an issue or candidate. So it's fitting that a discussion about possibilities for the 2014 election cycle in Arkansas would take place at the new Starbucks inside the Smith Pendergraft Campus Center on the University of Arkansas Fort Smith campus. But this conversation wasn't about issues and not even about specific candidates. UAFS this month will host a workshop designed to help people seeking office be able to navigate the maze of electoral politics.
And yes, it doesn't matter if you're an independent, if you're a Democrat, if you're from the Sunshine Party or whatever it may be.
Henry Rennie is the dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. This week, he discussed the ideas behind this first ever workshop to be held over 2 days later this month.
These things apply to everybody, that you are going to file for office and that you have to do certain things in terms of preparing that paperwork. All of these kinds of things are what we're gonna be covering in this workshop.
Hundreds of people this year will decide to run for office, from school board positions to city councils to state legislative seats. Making the decision to run for public office may be the easiest part of the process for a novice. Henry Rennie says the workshop is an extension of the new political science department at UAFS. Launched after increased interest in the major, Rennie says the workshop is intended to be part of the school's public service outreach.
We are expanding things that we're doing to not only for the students here on campus, but also for the community. And that's one of the main reasons why we're doing this, is that, we operate under a political system that depends on citizen participation. And so this workshop was designed in order to give people insight and knowledge, background, into how to run for office. What do I do? How do I construct a campaign? How do I raise money? How do I get my message across? All of those sorts of things.
The symposium is open to possible political candidates in not just Arkansas, but Oklahoma and Missouri as well. Those who attend will hear from people who have run for and won political races from both sides of the aisle. The keynote speaker is Shane Broadway, a former state legislator who is now the director of the Department of Higher Education in Arkansas. There will also be representatives from local ad agencies and others familiar with campaigns. Rennie says a subject that can be particularly problematic for first-time candidates, campaign funds, will be addressed.
Fundraising in particular has gotten a lot of PR lately. There's been a lot in the press that there are a lot of ins and outs and legal things, ethical, not just ethics, but the actual legalities of how to use campaign funds and what you can and can't use those funds for. So we're not going to say that this is going to be a course we're going to prepare you to operate as a legal advisor or anything, but we're going to try to make people aware of these pitfalls and filing deadlines, and that you have to fill out forms about your fundraising periodically and provide the information to the state.
Even somebody with just a cursory interest in Arkansas politics is probably aware of recent problems office holders have had with campaign funds. One constitutional officer has resigned because of ethics-related charges. Another scheduled to do so February 1st. Henry Rennie says the meeting January 24th and 25th should help.
And often their excuse will be, oh, gee, I didn't know, or I wasn't aware of that, or it's just a... But, you know, this is the law. We expect the people who run for office to have knowledge of the laws and to follow those, yes.
Organizers say topics covered should make the event attractive not just for political candidates, but also potential campaign managers or public relations types. The UAFS Center for Lifelong Learning is helping administer the workshop, and Jeff Adams, the director for the center, says interest is apparent from a wide range of people.
With the type of audience we anticipate coming and attending the seminar, we also have the opportunity, if you are a vendor that provides materials, supplies, advertising to this type of audience, then there is that opportunity to take a table and be in front of this audience as well.
Organizers say they think the symposium is a first for this region. They say they can't find many examples of similar workshops anywhere in the country, though there are some designed for people seeking national office that are held around the Washington, D.C. area. Henry Rennie, the dean of the UAFS College of Humanities and Social Sciences, says he wants this and possible future workshops to be the antithesis of cynical attitudes toward the electoral process.
Getting involved. Everybody talks, everybody has an opinion, everybody complains, but when it comes down to it, if you want to make change happen in this world, you have to get involved. You have to go be and be a part of the system. And this helps you to navigate that system and helps you get at least the entree and the basic understanding of all the ins and outs, the underlying things that you have to do in order to get yourself elected to office.
Jeff Adams says a meet and greet scheduled for the end of the first day of the workshop could also possibly help create some goodwill when possible Republican candidates and possible Democrats can introduce themselves to each other.
And an evening mixer for the candidates to sort of get together and get to know each other. Hopefully coming from different parts of the state and even Oklahoma. We've kind of targeted both Oklahoma and Arkansas with this seminar.
The cost of the workshop is $125. It's officially titled, So You Want to Get Elected. It's scheduled to take place January 24th and 25th at the Blue Lion. That's downtown Fort Smith, a venue formerly known as Second Street Live. You can register by calling the UAFS Center for Lifelong Learning at 788-7220, or you can follow a link that's at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. And before the end of the conversation this week, Henry Rennie was asked which he thought was more difficult, running for office or starting a degree program at a university like the new political science program at UAFS.
That's a great question, but both of them take a lot of planning and motivation, that you have to be motivated. But there's also, you know, getting a new program approved at a university level, you have to navigate a tremendous amount of bureaucracy to get those approved at various levels. And the same thing has to happen when you're running for office, that you have to have the right kind of paperwork filled out, you have to go to the right agencies, and of course, ultimately, you have to get the voters to elect you. So there's a lot of that is very similar.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
If you own or drive a car, hopefully you won't have to encounter one. But accidents do happen, and chances are good that at some point in your driving career, you will have to call a tow truck. I checked in with Bob Spinato, a driver with Action Towing in Springdale, to find out three things we need to know about towing. He said the first thing is for people to realize that there are two different types of tow trucks.
You've got your flatbed tow trucks, which haul basic automobiles, pickups, they'll haul just about anything. Your new all-wheel drive cars are harder to haul behind the original boom-type truck. Most of them have to go on to a flatbed pickup if you want to do any type of distance. So that's one basic thing you need to know. If you have an all-wheel drive car, generally speaking, they want it on a flatbed.
Action Towing has four flatbed trucks and two boom trucks. A boom truck is what most people picture when they think of a tow truck. A typical truck in front, but the back has a long bar or boom that extends from the bed. Attached are winches and pulleys. Though he says flatbed trucks are now your everyday tow truck. 90% of the work Bob sees is insurance work. A lot of warranty work on new cars that have broken down, or fender benders. Most warranties and insurance providers require clients to take their cars to a specific location for repairs or estimates.
One real good thing to know about your tow insurance is if it has a dollar coverage, a maximum dollar coverage, or a maximum mile coverage. That's where people get into trouble. They think that, you know, they can get picked up and taken anywhere, and they end up being over mileage and have to have some out-of-pocket costs. So that's a good thing to look at on your insurance, is find out exactly how far you can be towed or who you can be towed to through your insurance. There's limits to certain insurance policies. So that's one big thing to know.
And the third thing to know involves safety. The safety of the tow truck driver, the customer, and other drivers.
If you're going down the road and you see the lights on the side of the road, we're working on somebody's car that's right on the edge of the road, please slow down and move over. it's really dangerous out there. It's not the, you know, We're not towing up on the Coca-Cola or anything, but 5:40 in the middle of the afternoon is a pretty scary place to be when you're 2 feet off the side of the road and people are running by you at 80, 90 miles an hour. So that's as far as towing, that's safety's a big concern in this business, because people not paying attention can get other people hurt.
Recent winter weather and cold temperatures had many a vehicle off the road, in ditches and other precarious locations due to a slip and slide on the icy asphalt. Safety is also a concern when it comes to cold and stuck cars.
When it is bad like that, all the tow companies are just busy, busy, busy. It takes a long time, so make sure that you have, just like they tell you on all the safety programs, have you some water in your car, something to eat, an extra blanket. When it's cold outside, because when it's really bad, it sometimes, you know, we've got to go slow like everybody else. And if there's three or four people in front of them, it may take 2 hours to get to somebody. So safety, and that's a really good practice, is have you some extra clothes, have you something to drink, or make sure your cell phone's charged up.
As far as towing out these iced and snowed in cars, Bob says this is when they use the boom trucks the most. They are more reliable in the winter elements, and since most vehicles aren't broken down and merely need to be pulled out and placed back in the right direction on the road, they aren't going any distance, and a flatbed isn't necessary. In last week's winter weather, he says Action Towing saw about 14 calls a day. One of the two boom trucks, though it's under repair, was just a few feet from where Bob and I spoke. Having never stood next to one before, it is larger than I imagined and can haul box trucks, though it's not large enough to haul semis. This truck has a dual winch system, and once the boom is raised,
pull the cables down to the front end of his car, strapped to it, and then with this boom, it's able to extend out about 8 feet and up at over a 45 degree angle, so you can pick up a vehicle and pull it to you and set it down.
Much of the work is actually done with the tow truck driver outside of the truck, maneuvering the trapped vehicle with one of the levers from a row of several at the rear left of the truck.
Well, you've got your the back set of levers is all for your boom. You've got two winch cables. This is your cable in and cable out. This is up and down, extending in and out. And what else do we have here? Oh, and this is your wheel lift tilt. It goes for the wheel lift section.
The wheel lift is used if the boom is not and the vehicle is towed directly behind the truck. Bob has been towing with Action Towing for 5 years and says his favorite part of the job is that you never know what you're going to come across.
It might be unlocking some poor girl that's locked her keys in her car at midnight. Or you may go out and have to pull a car out of a tree. I mean, and that's actually happened. We've had cars that have been suspended in trees out by the lake. You know, they'll run off a hauler and land in a tree and have to actually grab a hold of the car, cut down the tree, take it down. It can be an involved situation.
Though he has seen some strange things, Bob Spinato says seeing a car in a tree is, well, different. For more information or for a tow, call 479-750-7600. This is Ozarks at Large.
Last Friday, Crystal Bridges hosted a screening of the award-winning film Georgia O'Keeffe. The film, which is the only film portrait O'Keeffe allowed to be made about herself, premiered at the National Gallery of Art and was first shown on PBS in 1977 as a celebration of the artist's 90th birthday. The documentary was created by filmmaker Perry Miller Addato, who was present at the recent screening and has participated in a number of events throughout Northwest Arkansas during the past few days, including paying a visit to a documentary class on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this week.
As I said, I didn't want to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be in the theater. I wanted to be an actress from the time I was 10 years old. And they tell me that when I was 2 years old, that I used to sing and dance for family groups, and then say, "Why don't you clap for me?"
Addato grew up in Yonkers, New York, and was a moderate success as an actress in radio, off-Broadway, and early television. But her career path changed during World War II. It was then that she began to understand what fascism meant, and she realized there were things that needed to be done in the world that might not be done if she didn't do them. The turning point in Adato's life came when she had a great experience at the Museum of Modern Art, where she saw director Frank Capra's Why We Fight series. The series was intended to motivate soldiers.
I went and I saw those films, and it just changed my life, because I realized the power of the film medium. I mean, and I have never changed my mind that film is for conveying emotion, for conveying ideas, for changing people's minds, or educating them, or telling them anything, that film is the most powerful.
Adato has gone on to have a successful career and is best known as a director and producer of biographical films about artists and writers. Her subjects include Gertrude Stein, Pablo Picasso, Carl Sandburg, and Alfred Stieglitz. Adato won an Emmy Award in 1968 for her initial directorial efforts in the film Dylan Thomas, The World I Breathe. In 1978, she became the first woman to win a Directors Guild of America Award for the most outstanding achievement in documentary for her Georgia O'Keeffe film. She has earned a number of other awards throughout her career, including a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Festival of Films on Art, Montreal. If you're going to do an interview, Adato says, it's very important to know an awful lot about that person. This is a lesson she learned while meeting with Virgil Thompson at the Chelsea Hotel in New York.
Trying to be charming, I said, Mr. Thompson, I'm going to ask the obvious question. How did you meet Gertrude Stein? He looks at me and he says, Miss Miller, I was Miss Miller at that time. Miss Miller, this is all in my book. I didn't even know he had written a book. Can you imagine going to see him? I didn't know he had written. It's called Virgil Thompson by Virgil Thompson. And it's all there. You know, anything that I wanted to know about his relationship, it's all there. And so I said, yes, of course. And we made an appointment later, and I came back after I knew what I was doing.
Documentarian Perry Miller Adato says research, which can be very exciting, is also important in the funding aspect of filmmaking. She says it's helpful to know a subject from the point of view that different people might be interested in. Finding funding often requires writing grant proposals. Adato says the National Endowment for the Humanities has given her 6 grants, some of which have been the largest grants she has received.
You do a proposal, and you also have to learn a lot about what it is that they want in a proposal. You know, what the form is. It took a while. I'll never forget when I wanted to do a proposal. I started for Carl Sandburg. And I thought I had done a couple of pages, and I thought it was pretty good. And I showed it to Tammy Robinson, who had worked for the NEH and who was the head of programming at that time. She said, Perry, this is not an NEH proposal. And she taught me, really, what it was. And for one of the things that's very, very important to know is they submit all of their proposals to a group that's going to critique it, and decide whether or not you're going to get funded. And they can be very tough. And some of them will like it, and some of them will not like it.
With the Stieglitz film, for example, Adato says the NEH originally did not think her film would be broad enough. However, they encouraged her to come back, which Adato says was important. After doing some more research, she submitted another proposal and ended up receiving a grant for $450,000. Another film whose initial proposal needed some revisions was Paris, The Luminous Years, Toward the Making of the Modern. The film itself had been a long time coming. In 1969, Adato, who was working at NET, a national public television organization that preceded PBS, wanted to do a program about Paris from 1905 to 1930, a time when the city was a mecca for creative artists. The NET executive felt the subject was interesting but too broad and asked Adato to narrow the focus down to one person who represented the era. The result was Adato's film on Gertrude Stein. Adato eventually did get to make her film about Paris, which was broadcast in prime time on PBS in 2010.
It was a great source of joy to finally do it. And I'll never forget the opening we had at the Alliance Française in New York, an invited audience. And to be able to say that this is, instead of saying it's a film I've always wanted to do, it was a film that I had done, and of course the audience reaction was wonderful. And it was a great source of satisfaction. And I feel that what we did in the film, so many films have been done about Paris, but nobody ever really did it from the point of view of place, of the importance of place in art, for certain artists especially, and Paris's role, why Paris was so important, why Paris, you know.
Having had such a long and successful career, Adato has learned a number of helpful tips for filmmakers. For example, she says if you see a shot you need, get it now instead of saying you'll get it later. That's because you never come back, and even if you do, things like lighting will be different. Adato also says creating a good film often takes much work during the editing phase. But with the constant changes, how do you know when a film is finished?
If you don't know when it's right, you're in the wrong business. And you, at some point, you have to know when it's right. And it can be very tough, you know, it can be very tough. But the editing is very important, and of course music is tremendously important. And don't be satisfied easily with whoever is helping you get the music. And don't hesitate to be a pain in the ass.
Adato says music will not save your film if the film is not good, but it can make all the difference in making a good film a very good film. Another piece of advice Adato offers to aspiring filmmakers is don't get discouraged because it is a tough business.
It's not one of the easier lives to choose, but it's fascinating. I mean, you learn so much and you meet people that you would never meet before. And I can't think of anything I could have done with my life that would be more interesting in the places that you would go, and the reading that you would do, and the kind of things. It's an absolutely, and your chance to change things or to enrich people's lives.
Perry Miller Adato's film, Paris, The Luminous Years, Toward the Making of the Modern, will be screened April 25th at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. For more information about the director, you can visit perrymilleradato.com. For more on the event, you can visit crystalbridges.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Berryville.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back alongside her co-host, Kyle Kellums.
We will.
And we'll end today's show with some music by Bones, Jugs, and Harmony, an Illinois band who will be performing at Smoke and Barrel Tavern tonight here in Fayetteville. You can find out more about them at bonesjugs.harmony.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great Wednesday.
Well, them Sunday morning blues, they got me down in the dumps. My body's a creek and I'm stuck in a slump. The coffee's burnt and my smokes are all wet. So save my soul, buy me one cigarette. And Saturday night wasn't what it's cracked.
to be. Keg was tapped, good times got away from me. I tried to look good, I was done at my best. Showing up as half, I still failed the test. I got some Sunday morning.